get on with the great pleasure of introducing our keynote speaker today. This really is somebody for this audience who doesn't need any introduction, but I will simply say it's a pleasure to have you here. Very productive scholar in many fields, whose great big book, Territory, has just arrived in my mailbox. And I'm not quite sure what calculation I should do relating to the book called Territory. Let me simply say that it is a major work of scholarship, and that is marked. The metric, I think, is clear that there's 174 pages of documentary endnotes to it. So seeing as we're talking about calculations and metrics, I will leave you with that one as an indication of the stature of the scholar who's about to talk to us. Welcome, Stuart.
Thank you, Simon, for that introduction, and I'm very grateful for the invitation from the organising committee to give this lecture. And while I've written about calculation before, particularly in relation to the work of Michel Foucault and Metin Heidegger, I don't really work on global governance or calculative regimes. And rather than trying to reinvent what I do, what I decided I would do is to try to offer some more general reflections on the relation between calculation and the globe, or more precisely, the Earth. And given what we've already heard today, I think that was a sensible choice, because in terms of the empirical calculative detail, all of the other presentations are far ahead of what I can do or what I can offer around those kinds of questions. So already at this workshop, we've heard about economies, visibility, mobilities, calculative tactics in relation to the environment, security, humanitarian aid. And tomorrow, we've got panels on calculating bodies, borders and population, and sites of resistance to and immunity from calculation, a notion that I like under the name of anti-metrology, and Rhys Smackold talked a little about what that notion might mean today. And that notion of measure, of metron, and its relation to calculation is going to be one of the themes in what I'm going to talk to you about this evening. The other is the globe, the Earth, the geo notion. What was striking to me reading the abstracts and then today listening to the papers was that the second of these, the globe, was largely absent from the papers that we've heard so far today. A lot of papers are about governance, about regimes and calculation, but the global element of the workshop title seemed to be somewhat underplayed, seemed to be somewhat underinterrogated. Now, if we look at all of the papers and the different themes that come through the paper, there's a number of common threads or themes that keep coming up, much to do with calculation, about the calculation in relation to the economy, in relation to the labor market or the notion of manpower, calculations of risk, the metrics of ratings, and so on. And I could continue through all of the papers identifying some of these common strands or common threads, much to do with this notion of calculation. And broadly speaking, calculation in relation to a number of other questions: risk, security, prediction, aid, sustainability, development, finance, the economy, population. But the frames within which all of those things operated, within which these modes of action worked, these modes of government were taking place, were the regional, the national, the international, the global. But the frames themselves, these kind of spaces, the geographies of them, weren't really the specific focus of the papers that we've heard or the interventions. Perhaps in Suzanne's work on the notion of the space of the camp, or in Rhys's work on the transfer from one space, one context to another, we perhaps got closest to these questions. But it's the frames that I really want to try and interrogate today, the spaces within which, between which, and over which the regimes operate, shape, and calculate. Because that question links to some work I've been trying to do over the past several years, thinking about the global, and thinking about the global in relation to two other terms, the world and the Earth. And it strikes me as somewhat peculiar that there's so much work on globalization, including globalization as a research topic within geography, and yet the kind of particular geographies of globalization have not really been worked through or interrogated, particularly in terms of the relation globalization has to questions of space and territory. And at the same time, there's been work in a more philosophical register where philosophers have tried to think the notion of the world, and the world particularly as a concept that precedes any simple extension of economic, political, social, cultural phenomena across the globe. And yet those philosophical accounts of the world have often been incredibly detached from the things that are actually going on, the particular kind of practices that are actually shaping and reshaping the globe, its constituent states and territories. And where philosophical ideas have been transplanted into the humanities and social sciences more generally, that's often been at the expense of sufficient nuance about it. One example that seems to me particularly egregious in that regard is the widespread adoption of the term deterritorialization to describe globalization, when at most what we're being observed is a remaking of spatial relations rather than some kind of end of those. And it seems to me that the continuities between the state-territorial modern world and globalization are struggling to be conceived because the conditions that made both possible are poorly interrogated. Now, I began this work on the notion of the world by examining some of the philosophical works that I thought were useful in this. And Martin Heidegger's work was important in there, but a number of other thinkers, all of which I think are operating in the wake of Heidegger's analysis, I think are more important or more useful on this. Eugen Fink's book Spiel als Weltsymbol, Play as a Symbol of the World, and Kostas Axelos's Le Jeu de Monde, The Game of the World or The Play of the World, seem to me to be still largely untapped philosophical resources for thinking about the world and processes of what Axelos calls mondialisation, worldization or becoming worldly, and that he contends that this notion of mondialisation, the term that precedes the English word globalization by a couple of decades, the globalization, he says, is a kind of mondialisation without the world. That the process becomes more important than the object over which things are extended or transformed. That the scale is almost forgotten in terms of that analysis. Now, the French Marxist Henri Lefebvre picks up in some of these ideas in a much more explicitly kind of political and political economy manner in his probably most famous book in English, The Production of Space, but also in a book called De l'État, a four-volume book that he wrote immediately after The Production of Space, some parts of which Neil Brenner and I translated into this collection, State, Space, World. And more recently, the work of Peter Sloterdijk, German philosopher, have been picked up, particularly his book Spheres, which looks at spheres from the womb up to the globe and everything in between, and looking at spheres as particular kinds of environs that humans live in and transform through their practices. And that's a book that's being translated by Semiotext at the moment. Now, all of this work on the concept of the world, a number of questions seem to come up for me. How did the world become an object of thought? How is this related to the world becoming an object of practice? And what potential is there for rethinking the world and the way the world is constructed without simply falling into mechanistic, technocratic ways of rendering the world? What we might call, following the title of this workshop, regimes of global calculation. To think the world of globalization forces us to realize this isn't a transcending of spatial or territorial problematics, but their reconfiguration. And that territory, which I've argued should be understood as the political corollary of calculative space as a political technology, territory, I think, still offers us insight into the things that are happening under globalization, into what Lefebvre calls the world scale or the notion of the worldwide. And in Lefebvre's terms, l'échelle mondiale is not the same thing as le niveau global. The world scale is distinct from the global or the general level. That the process of globalization is in effect an acceleration of the understanding of space and time of modernity, coordinates on a three- and four-dimensional calculative grid. That the understanding of space and time as calculative, with extension as the primary characteristic of material nature, is to make it amenable to science through geometry and measure more generally. And that on that argument, it's a difference of degree rather than an ontological transformation that is the way to try and understand the spatialities of globalization. Now, that work for me ran into something of a dead end. And more recently, I've been trying to work on this from a slightly different angle in trying to think about the concept of the Earth and what role that might play in relation to the notion of geopolitics. Because it seems to me that geopolitics today has become something of a synonym for global or international politics. And you still have these armchair strategists who come up with their grand plans for understanding and changing the world, and critical geopolitics scholars offer broad analyses of just such strategies and the interlinked relations of capital, state power, nationalism, and territory. So Robert Kaplan's recent The Revenge of Geography seems to be destined to be what many people understand of the notion of geography, especially in policy circles, as if exhuming the ghost of Mackinder was the way forward, or they read Harm de Bly's latest offering of Why Geography Matters. But even the critical geopolitics work seems to me to run into a problem in that it tends to think of this as global or world politics, new ways of understanding or making sense of that particular scale. But could geopolitics be rethought in a way that's closer to the etymological root of that term as earth politics, but for progressive political purposes? And that's one of the things I'm going to try and think through in today's talk. The geopolitics literally does mean the politics of the geo, the earth, land, planet, or world. And all of those, I think, would need careful conceptual work and to be distinguished from each other as well as related to each other. But here, what I'm going to try and talk about is the question of the earth. Now, with earth, there's a number of etymological considerations in terms of what that concept might mean in the English language. The word earth, the very word earth, can be traced back to Anglo-Saxon roots. So the word eorth is found in the Beowulf poem, for instance, in phrases such as eorthsela, an earth hall, or eorthdraka, an earth dragon. And there's a range of related words to this English word of earth in the Germanic languages. Earth in Old Frisian, earth in Anglo-Saxon, erde in Old High German, from which we get the German earth, the German erde, and the Dutch aarde. And Shakespeare uses the word earth with a real precision in some of his writings, particularly in King Lear and Richard II. And a much longer version of this paper goes into readings of those plays as to what Shakespeare's doing with those notions. But what's interesting about the English language is that it isn't solely formed from Germanic roots. The importance of the Norman conquest in English history is not simply in terms of the politics and the social and the economic considerations, but it also shapes the language. And it's interesting how you can see traces in the language that actually mirror some of those political, social, economic considerations. So my favourite example of this is an example I use when I'm teaching about the history of ideas, is in Sir Walter Scott's novel Ivanhoe, where a Saxon peasant is told that there's a reason for the difference between the names given to animals and the names given to their meat. So swine, ox, and calves are tended by Saxons, but they're eaten as pork, beef, and veal by Normans, the first set of words being of Anglo-Saxon origin, the latter set from Norman French, and that the language mirrors the social divisions within that society. Now, with earth words, we have something similar. We don't just have the Anglo-Saxon root, but we have other roots for words that are related to earth words in English. The French, through the Latin, is a particular example. So Frantz Fanon's book, The Wretched of the Earth, is Les Damnés de la Terre, and the French terre and the Latin terra form the root of many English words, terrestrial, terrain, even the dog a terrier. And that we also get Latinate phrases that come into the language, terra firma, terra incognita, terra nullius. But there's another Latin root to words that appear similar, but actually comes from a different etymological branch. This is the notion of terrare, to frighten, to warn off. And so terrorist, terrify come from that different root. And many of you will know that there's a debate about where the word territory comes from. Is it from the word land, earth, terra, or is it from a place that people are frightened off or warned away from, terrare? And there's been a literature examining this. You can see this in a number of people. William Connolly, Mark Nearcliffe, Barry Hindus have all written about that relation between those terms. Now, having Anglo-Saxon and therefore Germanic roots to the language alongside the Latin Norman French ones isn't unusual in modern English. The example from Ivanhoe gives you that. But there's a third set of words in English that have a different set of etymological relations, deriving from the Greek root. This is the geo word, the geo meaning, or from the g, from meaning earth or land. And you find that in words like geometry, geography, geology, and geopolitics. But in those, I think we're perhaps losing that element of the geo as earth and replacing it with other ideas. So the argument I just made, geopolitics being reconceived as global politics, geometry as a branch of mathematics, abstract and detached, geography not as earth writing, but as a kind of spatial sensibility to work that might easily have been done in other disciplines. And perhaps it's only in geology that we actually find some return to the etymological roots of this term, the logos of the geo, the logos of the earth itself. But as the philosopher Robert Frodemann has noted, the term geology, which once identified exclusively with the study of the solid earth, has lost grounds to earth sciences, which argue for an integrated study of air, water, soil, rock, ice, and biota. Now, it's that etymological root, the earth politics, and as I'm going to try and argue, the earth metrics or the earth measuring in the sense of geopolitics in today's talk on geometrics that I want to try and think through. Now, as early as Aristotle, there's a recognition of the detachment that is happening between a practical science of earth measuring and an abstract science of geometry. He suggests in the Metaphysics, geometry differs from measurement of the earth only in the latter deals with what we perceive, whereas the former deals with the unperceived. Now, he's using this to try and justify reflection on practices rather than just analysis of the practices. But there's an important distinction that I think is being introduced there in Aristotle, which anticipates the way that geometry becomes more and more abstract as a branch of mathematics, especially in the analytic geometry of Descartes in the 17th century and those that came after him. Now, these different etymologies that I've just tried to sketch out, I think, have political implications. They have political resonances that are important. And it's sometimes suggested that the Anglo-Saxon roots of English give a more rudimentary, indeed even earthy sense than the Latinate Norman French ones. We sometimes hear it said that somebody is speaking using Anglo-Saxon language, a rudimentary, crude sense of language. And it's often used as a synonym, effectively, for worldly concerns, the profane, the non-spiritual, the secular. St. Augustine, for example, distinguishes famously between the city of God and the earthly city. And he notes how in Genesis, God fashioned man out of the dust of the earth. The heaven and earth contrast, of course, is important throughout the Middle Ages, particularly, and this is an argument I make in the Birth of Territory book, how the medieval distinction between eternal spiritual power on the one hand and temporal, secular, earthly power on the other becomes recoded as the notion of territorial sovereignty or extraterritorial power of the papacy. And that the reactionary politics starts to come in through some of these notions. If you look at the way that earth or land or soil have been often used as something that people appeal to in politics, you can see some of those questionable political resonances there. The notion of soil, of Blut und Boden in Nazi thought, or of the notion of land, the homeland, the fatherland, the motherland, the promised land, the holy land, Eretz Israel, land of our fathers, and so on. So that a reactionary politics is very close to some of this appeal to an idea of retrieving a sense of earth politics in geometry or geopolitics. And you can find this in a number of instances. If you go back to the Greek myths of autochthony, the very idea that the founders of cities were born from the very soil of the place that they now inhabit and rule over. Examples of the first king of Athens being born from the soil himself after the failed rape of the goddess Athena, from which the city takes its name. Or the dragon teeth that were sown into the soil of Thebes and sprung forth as the dragon warriors that ruled that city. Or the noble lie of Plato's Republic. All of these giving rise to ideas of noble birth, of rootedness in a particular location, of attachment to place, and a disavowal of the role of women in the birth of kings and of warriors. So this geopolitics that's the politics of the earth, rather than of the globe, might easily collapse into that reactionary politics. Friedrich Ratzel's notion of Lebensraum, Martin Heidegger's distinction between earth and world and his reimagining of autochthony, Carl Schmitt's nomos of the earth would be an example of those kind of reactionary politics that go alongside this. Drawing on the ancient Greek meaning, Schmitt argues that the nomos means both a law and a division, arguing nomos is the measure by which the ground and soil of the earth in a particular order is divided and situated. It's also the form of political, social, and religious order determined by that process, stressing that relation between the earth and the measure in the particular way he wants to conceptualize politics. And Schmitt arguing about a new emergence of a particular way of thinking and organizing and ordering these things that comes in the late 15th century through the circumnavigation of the world, of starting to conceive of the earth as a globe, as a ball that can be circumnavigated. Even though people knew long before this that the earth was a sphere, the actual practical side of this that emerges through these processes, Magellan's voyage of the early 16th century and so on, the new global spatial order that he finds emerging out of these practices. The case of Heidegger, I think, is more instructive, and I'm going to say something about what I think Heidegger does to try to respond to this reactionary politics in his later writings in a moment. But Heidegger certainly in the 1930s thinks that you can trace a number of the problems of modern thought through processes of translation. Roman-Latin translation of Greek thought, for him, is one of the key problems in Western thought. Because, he says, they take away the original sense of the words, the rootedness in Greek thought in their transition into the Latin language. So he calls this notion of bodenlosigkeit, of loss of soil or loss of rootedness in a context, and opposes it to a notion of bodenstandlichkeit, of rootedness in the soil, something that might be called his philosophical autochthony, that concepts come from a particular context, and his reactionary appeal to the German homeland, the German Heimat and the rootedness in a particular location that comes in his work. And this comes through in his reading of the poet Friedrich Hölderlin, where he makes recurrent appeals to the notion of earth, suggesting that this is separate from a simple geographical, which he glosses as an Erdbeschreibung, an earth description. It's something that's different from a mere geopolitical territorial understanding, but it's something that has a rootedness in the context that the German people understand. And the earth, he says, is something that is a homeland that is readied for the gods. We also find this in his reading of a painting by Van Gogh, which Heidegger takes to be a pair of peasant shoes. It's only a short passage here, but Heidegger goes into this long, laboured kind of attempt at sort of poetry on the model of Hölderlin about kind of what these shoes might mean, and that the peasant woman and the world of the peasant woman and the earth that she inhabits that emerges through these shoes and so on. There's a big dispute about whether these were even a pair of peasant shoes or whether they were actually Van Gogh's own boots that he used to walk in the streets of Amsterdam, which would kind of take away the ground for Heidegger's whole analysis at this point. And earth appears in the later Heidegger again in a passage from Hölderlin that he continually quotes, a passage from a fragment of Hölderlin's writings after Hölderlin descended into madness, but Heidegger keeps citing this passage. And what's interesting about this passage is the relation of the earth to this notion of measure, which is this theme I want to keep picking up and talking about today. Is there a measure on the earth? There is none. Is God unknown? Is he manifest as the sky? This rather I believe. It is the measure of the human. Full of acquirements, but poetically, the human dwells on the earth. And it's that notion that Heidegger wants to retrieve of a different earth measure that he's trying to work through in a lot of his later writings. And arguably, it's through that critique of the notion of measure, the critique of the notion of calculation, that Heidegger seeks to make sense of Nazism and to make sense of his own political involvement with the Nazi Party. Because it's interesting that these works, where he's first making the appeal to Hölderlin, where he's providing the reading of Van Gogh, these are at the very moment of the Nazi rise to power. Lectures on Hölderlin are from 1934 onwards, The Origin of the Work of Art and The Introduction to Metaphysics, the other place where he talks about Van Gogh, come from 1935. But Heidegger comes to realise that his appeal to the earth, his appeal to this rootedness, has very little to do with what the Nazis are talking about with notions of Blut und Boden. And yet, in these texts, where Heidegger keeps making these appeals to notions of earth, of soil, the destiny of a historical folk, a historical people, even if Heidegger's trying to argue that these are not the same as the way the Nazis are, the context is far too close for comfort, and there's a real kind of implication and imbrication of these notions are tangled up together. And again, this kind of reactionary politics comes through in these kinds of questions. A number of calls today for religious, national, cultural rights to particular lands, particular earths. Israel's claims to the West Bank, Argentina's claim to Las Malvinas, Spain's claim on Gibraltar, other contested territories such as Western Sahara and Kashmir, self-determination movements the world over, many of them resisting colonial practices, many of them in that resistance replicating colonial practices in that relation to the earth. But, and this is the point I want to keep coming back to, is there an alternative to such politics and such ways of imagining political space? What if there were resources in other places, whether in the later Heidegger or in Deleuze and Guattari's work on geophilosophy or Elizabeth Gross's work on geopower? Are there resources in this to try to think geopolitics as earth politics in a different way? Particularly in Heidegger, does his work on calculation help as a way of making sense of earth measuring, this notion of geometrics? Now, I tried to work this through in relation to Heidegger in detail in a 2006 book called Speaking Against Number. And the title of that book tried to work in two ways. As a phrase, a simple phrase, speaking against number, language as opposed to calculation, arguing against calculation. But also by taking those three words in that title as the particular themes that I was looking at in the book, speaking against a number, so that they became sort of three cuts through the question of Heidegger and politics. Speaking, the first chapter was about rhetorical politics. The second chapter against was about polemical politics, oppositional politics. And the third chapter on number was about calculative politics. The attempt was to try to say that if you looked at Heidegger's work from different periods and with different lenses, there were different ways of conceptualizing this relation between his work and politics. And in the third of them, there was something that we could maybe, for more progressive political purposes, appropriate from his work, even if we wanted to resist the ways that he understood politics in those first two senses. So in the 1920s, the crucial political text for Heidegger is by Aristotle, but it's not the politics or even the ethics, but it's the rhetoric, and that the rhetoric gives a model that Heidegger likes for a community posited on the basis of speaking and particularly listening. For Heidegger, hearing and belonging share a very important root. In German, the verbs are hören and gehören, that there's an etymological root there that Heidegger insists on, but he says that a language community constituted by speaking and listening is important. Incidentally, I think that's one of the reasons why Heidegger's nationalist politics is always a linguistic politics, a German-speaking peoples, rather than a simple racial or biological politics of the German race. It's much more to do with the language than it is to do with kind of ethnic kinds of questions. In those early texts of Heidegger in the 1920s, Heidegger doesn't talk about being in the world, which he talks about in Being and Time and later texts, but he talks about being in the polis. It's about constituting a political community. In the early 1930s, Heidegger turns to a different Greek text around these, and it's the Republic. It's Plato's Republic with the model of the philosopher kings. Not that you should have one person as both the philosopher and the king, but that one person, and Heidegger clearly means himself, should be the philosopher to the king. That the Führer, the leader, may need somebody to lead or to guide them. Den Führer was the famous phrase that Heidegger used in a letter, is that this is what he could provide to Hitler. He could provide that spiritual guidance and mentorship to that. The politics in that time for Heidegger quickly collapses into polemics. The Greek polemos, which Heidegger tries to work through in a number of texts and understand, he talks about polemos as what he calls an auseinandersetzung, a setting apart from another, a breaking apart from another. And here, the notion of logos as speech is the first conceptualization of politics, but in the second, it's polemos, which he translates variously as struggle, kampf, strife, or even as war, krieg. Now, in the third conceptualization, I think Heidegger's trying to make sense of both his own involvement, but also what Nazism has become, and Nazism is the most explicit form of modern politics taken generally. He tries to work through the implications of what he calls calculative politics, a particular determination of the political. And this isn't, like the other two, a positive determination, but a critique of where we've got to and the way that things have come. Now, for Heidegger, Descartes is the pivotal figure in this break. Rather than a strict distinction that Heidegger finds in Aristotle, Aristotle had proposed a strict distinction between arithmetic and geometry, between the mode of connection that makes up an arithmetic series and a geometrical continuum. Descartes, for Heidegger, turns geometry into a form of applied arithmetic, turns it into a form of calculation. And this, for Heidegger, has enormous political and social consequences. Two quotes from the beginning of Descartes' geometry text. All the problems in geometry can be reduced to such terms that a knowledge of the lengths of certain straight lines is sufficient for their construction. Or, in the method I use, all problems which present themselves to geometers reduce to a single type, namely to the question of finding the values of the roots of an equation. That geometrical problems can be turned into equations, the length of lines, the quantity of lines, a problem of number, that Heidegger suggests is a radical break from the way that arithmetic and geometry were conceptualized in Greek thought. It gets technical here, but it's to do with the way that Aristotle talks about the modes of co-being or being together in the physics. And Aristotle talks about different modes of connection, different modes of association, of which arithmetic takes one path and geometry takes another path. That the mode of connection of the geometric in the Greek thought, Aristotle suggests, is characterized by what he calls the synarches, or loosely a continuum. The series of numbers, where no touching between the elements within that series of numbers is necessary, is characterized by an epheses, which is loosely something like a sequence. Now, Descartes' geometry, because he reduces all the geometrical problems to the length of lines, i.e. a question of number, or the roots of an equation, a mathematical formula, is effectively fracturing the continuum. He's turning the continuum into a sequence. Another way of thinking about this is if you look at differential calculus, and where it's trying to find, say, the space underneath the curve, what does it do? It fractures it into smaller and smaller pieces, of which you can get closer and closer approximations to the area under this. Now, this fracturing of the continuum is, Heidegger thinks, an important, not simply a kind of metaphysical way of or determination of the material world, but it has political consequences instead. And this is in particular importance in terms of how Descartes understands the notion of space. Space, for Descartes, is determined by the notion of extension. Extension is something that is amenable to understanding through mathematical coordinates, what we now call Cartesian coordinates. And that Heidegger suggests again and again what a radical break this is from the way that the Greeks thought about these questions. It's not simply a spatializing of calculation, but it's a calculation of space. That the continuum becomes a sequence of numbers, a multiplicity comprised of units, rather than something that is by its very nature indivisible. Now, Heidegger's work is picked up, there's two really, really important books for my thinking on this question. Jakob Klein's Greek Mathematical Thought and the Origin of Algebra, and David Lachtman's fantastic book, The Ethics of Geometry, the subtitle of which is A Genealogy of Modernity. And both of those books picking up on these ideas that Heidegger's trying to elaborate here, for the implications these have for the way that modernity conceives of space, but also for potentially the political consequences that come from this. Because Descartes insists again and again that geometry is the science that best helps us to make sense of the material world, that the material external world, what he calls res extensa, an extended thing, is amenable to calculation and to division. Now, in Heidegger's writings after the Second World War, the ones that were published in his lifetime or shortly after, Heidegger's main critiques through this mode of calculative technological politics are capitalism and communism. And his post-war writings on technology work in this fairly general register around the kind of malaise of the modern world. But in Heidegger's notebooks of the 1930s and his lectures of the 1930s, he has a very different target in mind when he's talking about these things. He relates these notions of calculation, of the fracturing of the continuum, of rendering differential things the same. The explicit targets that he has are things like Gleichschaltung, the Nazi policy of coordination, or literally same wiring, making everything amenable to being registered as a similar or a same kind of process of reducing things to a measurement towards a norm. He talks about this in terms of the mechanization policies of the Third Reich, in terms of total mobilization, in terms of the four-year plan and the particular kind of statistical measures or calculative regimes that were being imposed in these contexts. So these particular kinds of measures that he initially forges as a critique, a very private critique in private notebooks and so on in the 1930s, in response to Nazi politics and Nazi economics and its global strategies, this becomes in the later Heidegger and the way that Heidegger initially got picked up in terms of a much more generalized reduction of the world to calculability, to measurability, a modern malaise that you can find in Americanism, capitalism, and in communism. Other places where you might find, I think, related potential for thinking this in a non-reactionary kind of politics comes from work that's picking up on Deleuze and Guattari's thinking on deterritorialization and reterritorialization that seem to me to require a lot more careful work if we're to use those to make sense of the kinds of questions around globalization and political geographical relations more generally. Reterritorialization seems to me it might be a more productive way forward than deterritorialization. But about the notion of geophilosophy, which Deleuze and Guattari use in the What is Philosophy book, there's potential in that, and some geographers, I think, have begun to think through some of the implications in this. And this has particularly come out of an engagement with the work of Elizabeth Gross, particularly her book Chaos, Territory, Art on Deleuze and the Framing of the Earth, where she's trying to think about the relation between earth and territory, where territory has something added to it that transforms it from the mere earth. That territory is something that is framed, that has qualities or has measures, perhaps we might say, attributed to it as modes of ordering and construction. Now, I'm not going to go into huge detail about what Gross says, but I think there's real potential in this, and particularly in the way that Gross's work was engaged with by some geographers at the last but one Association of American Geographers meeting, where Gross's work was picked up by people who are trying to think kind of a more active geo within geography or geophysics or within geopolitics more generally, is to try to think about these relations and about this as a more active sense rather than this inert sort of container or platform over which this kind of politics works or thinks through. Now, Gross is working these questions through, but what she proposes is, I think, perhaps the most productive notion is this notion of geopower that she proposes. The relations between the Earth and its various forces and living beings, and they're not always distinguishable forces, are forms of geopower if power is to be conceived as the engagement of clashing competing forces. Power, a particular human form of this, the relations between humans, or perhaps even between living things, is a certain historically locatable capitalization on the forces of geopower. Now, at its best, this potential, I think, has real implications for how we do some of the questions that we're thinking about here and elsewhere in our conversations. Politics of the Earth that would take into account much more seriously the power of natural processes or resources, the dynamics of human environment, the interrelation of objects outside of human intervention, the relation between the biosphere, the atmosphere, and the lithosphere, the complex interrelations that produce, continually transform, and rework questions around territory and state spatial strategies. And there are a number of other people's work who I think we can bring into these conversations. Manuel de Landa's work on 1,000 years of nonlinear history, literary theorist Jonathan Bate's work on the way poetry can retrieve a connection to the earth, John Protevi's recent book on Deleuze and the sciences that talks about the hybrid multiplicity of geo-hydro, solar, bio, techno-politics to make sense of these complicated interconnections. And in a related inquiry, Jane Bennett, similarly wanting to retrieve an active, you might even say earthy sense to what she calls vibrant matter, so a kind of a material turn in geography and geopolitics. Now, the geographer Matthew Hanna has suggested that we need to think about biopower rather than just biopolitics, that biopolitics is a particular narrower set of questions within the larger question of biopower. And so it is, I think, in relation to geopower and geopolitics. Within that wider rethinking of geopower, something that somebody like Elizabeth Gross can provide inspiration for, we can then perhaps resituate what we mean by geopolitics as a politics of the earth. And that geopolitics, for me, would sit alongside rather than replace the attention that goes to biopolitics in recent years. Now, Foucault's work on biopower, some of this has been mentioned already in this workshop, has been developed in a range of different ways, not always, I think, complementary or consistent ways. But with the lecture courses that have been published over the last several years, from Society Must Be Defended to the one that's only just come out in French, Du Gouvernement du Vivant, The Government of the Living, we can trace all of Foucault's interests in this matter. But it's this threefold relation that somebody like Matthew Hanna is proposing here that needs explication. Biopower, biopolitics, and I'd add to that biometrics. And the first two of those have been elaborated by people like Giorgio Agamben, Roberto Esposito, Harton Negri, Delannan Reid, and so on. Biometrics has been picked up by less people, but people like Louisa Moore and Joseph Pugliese have worked through some of these questions and so on. So just as there's that threefold relation between biopolitics, biopower, biometrics, there's a threefold relation that I'm trying to think through at the moment between geopower, geometrics, and geopolitics. Can we retrieve a sense of geometrics that is perhaps a more concrete material sense than the notion of geometry that the abstract mathematical version has become today? A more traditional sense of the term, a measuring of the earth as geometry. In Herodotus, there's a description of the original earth measurers, the Egyptians who were sent out to remark the boundaries of the farmers' fields in the Nile floodwater zones after the floodwaters have subsided. And Herodotus talks about these were the original earth measures, the original geometricians, the original people who did this work. It's been claimed that Thales was the first person who turned that very practical art into an abstract mathematical way of thinking, of taking that the Egyptian geometry of empirical measurement and turning it into an abstract and deductive process. And that original fundamental sense becomes increasingly abstract in Aristotle, in Euclid, and especially when it's fully mathematicized in the 16th and particularly the 17th century, the point I was making about Descartes a few moments ago. But there's various traces of this in the tradition. The work I did on the question of territory, I tried to suggest how important the technological was to the way that we should understand territory. The territory shouldn't be collapsed simply into economic questions or strategic questions, but there were important legal questions and technical questions about how we understand this question of territory, that measure and control of land and terrain are as important as simply the land and terrain in and of themselves. Territory is a political question, a geographical question, but having economic, strategic, legal, and technical elements within that. And an early title of the book, one of the working title of the manuscript, was The Geometry of the Political, which became simply a section within a chapter towards the end, where I discussed Descartes, Newton, and others in terms of the political implications of their determinations of the material world. But there's other examples in there of this more kind of concrete sense of earth measuring that are perhaps worth looking at. One of the important texts, and I think far more important than the Caesar and Cicero and the Roman historians, is the Roman land surveyor's work. The Corpus Agrimensorum Romanorum, a body of writings by the Roman land surveyors, very practical in terms of boundary disputes between farmers, who owned which bits of land and so on. Those kind of questions were extremely important in shaping not simply the practices, but also the vocabulary to describe the practices or the concepts. There's also a 14th century Roman lawyer, Bartolus of Sassoferrato, who I argue is very important in his theoretical work, where he makes a link between territorium and jurisdiction, and that link that makes there. But he's also interesting because the story is he was on holiday walking down the side of the Tiber and became interested in some of the legal questions that arise from rivers and how rivers work. And around these questions, and these are the old questions of Justinian's Institutes, a compendium of Roman law from the 6th century, what happens to the possession of land if a river changes course? What happens to an island that emerges in the middle of a river? Who owns that? What happens if a river dries up entirely? Who owns the bed of the river? Now, these questions in Roman law are the questions in terms of farmers and their fields and about this kind of question. But these are exactly the same kind of questions that river boundaries between states today are issues around these questions. Now, the way that Bartolus tries to resolve this isn't the way that he resolves most of his legal questions, by working them through in reference to classical texts and drawing on examples from precedent and practice and so on. He actually does a rudimentary legal geography. And these two show you these diagrams where he's actually trying to sketch out. This is in the 14th century. This is before the mathematicization of geometry in the kind of Descartes sense. But it's a rudimentary legal geometry to try to make sense of these kinds of questions, of how you apportion an island that emerges in a river or a river changing course and so on. So it's a founding text, I think, of legal geography or legal geometry. And that original sense of the Egyptian geometry of earth measuring, a way of making sense of measures of the earth, and that we can extend that into what we've been talking about over the workshop today, this applied sense of land surveying and its relation to questions around population, questions around the metrics and the calculative strategies we've been looking at, but also extending it into things about yields of oil and gas, soil fertility, air quality, these kinds of calculations or measures that have been talked about. And there's a whole range of texts I think could be brought into this way of thinking about these kinds of questions. Three that struck me as I was writing this and some others that I'll briefly mention. But Phil Steinberg's work on the ocean and his emerging interest in ice. And ice is something that has dynamic geophysical properties that complicate any straightforward relation of either land territory law or maritime territory law, and that you need people who understand the dynamics of ice in order to understand how you might resolve some of the claims that are going on in the Arctic at present. Similarly, work on river boundaries, as I suggested, complicated by the dynamics of rivers. Or you could look at somebody like Sheila Krupa's work the book Hotspotters Report, The Legacies of Military Toxic Waste on Landscapes and Bodies within the continental United States. Or the way that somebody like Rachel Woodward has turned military geographies on its head, not simply about the way that geography is an important question for the military, but the impact that the military has on the geographical landscape in terms of the transformations through camps, through practice areas and so on, that what they actually do physically to the landscape. Reading just recently Matthew Huber's book Lifeblood on the kind of everyday geopolitics of oil within the American economy and how that's made particular kind of practice is important. Derek Gregory has turned to the question of terrain in what he's calling the natures of war, the kind of physical landscape over which wars are fought, whether it's the sands and the deserts, to the jungles, to the Arctic, and so on. Or the Polity Resources series, Polity Books Resources series, of which Derek Hall has written the book on land for that series, but thinking about the kind of physical properties, the geophysical properties of a number of these kinds of questions. Or the third of these is a book that Simon Dolby suggested that we should look at, John Perkins' book, Geopolitics and the Green Revolution, subtitle Wheat, Genes and the Cold War, and exploring how countries, the four countries he talks about, are the US, Britain, India and Mexico, all seeing agricultural production and genetic breeding of plants as a measure of national security, a way of making sense of these kinds of questions. Dolby noting, Cold War scholars will remember the importance of satellite-based estimates of the Soviet harvest, and that North Korea watchers are doing the same thing today, similar calculations being made. Or the work that Saskia Sassen has been doing recently on land grabs, feeding, and the word is important there, she suggests, the disassembling of national territory. There's also, of course, the question of population density. Population density being interesting in that it's a relation of biopolitics to geopolitics. It's the relation of number of people to area of land. Now, just as I've argued elsewhere that I think Foucault is misguided in suggesting that population comes to displace territory as the principal object of government, so too today, I think, is any overemphasis of the question of biopolitics over geopolitics. And it's precisely because the same kinds of calculative techniques are going on in both of those registers that I think we need to think about those things together. Strategies that would turn towards the object and constitution of population are similarly directed towards the object and constitution of territory. Territory, as I'm trying to argue, more as a process than an outcome, more a political technology than a simple container for political action. And it's these very same techniques that are developed in one register that are being applied in the other register, these calculative techniques, modes of measuring and controlling. And you find these in the geo area, the geopolitical area, land surveying, terrain analysis, cartographic practices, administrative strategies, statistical surveys, legal codes, financial techniques, military technologies, many of the same of which are going on in terms of the population, in terms of biopolitics, many of which we've been discussing so far in this workshop. We need to think about these calculative techniques in both biopolitical and geopolitical registers as what I'm calling biometrics and geometrics, measuring life and the earth. And just as those calculative techniques on both population and territory were essential tools of modern statecraft, so too are these similar kinds of techniques at this global context that are going on within what we're calling these regimes of global calculation today. Now, Simon Dolby's 2013 political geography lecture at the Association of American Geographers was entitled The Geopolitics of Climate Change. And in that essay, Simon generously picked up on a paper of mine called Secure the Volume, Vertical Politics and the Depth of Power, and tried to pick up on some of the ideas I'd been suggesting there. The first time I'd been talking about geometrics and thinking about geometrics in relation to this question of climate change. Now, what I try and do in that essay is to say that too often a political geography imagination has been of a flat, planar, aerial surface. We need to think about the up and the down, that we need to link an emerging field of work in what's being called vertical geopolitics, aerial bombardment, aerial surveillance, the way that cities are constructed with the control of the airspace above them as much as on the ground below. And what I tried to do was to link that to work on urban exploration, on urban infrastructure, on security issues around infrastructure and the policing of these kind of questions. And it was to try to suggest that if we look at these different dimensions, that we can broaden the area to the volume, that we can think about territory in a sense in sort of three dimensions rather than as the kind of cartographic imagination as a flat surface. And my examples were of the West Bank, which has been discussed by people like A.L. Weissman before, Israel's border with Lebanon at Rosh Hanikra, the work that Peter Sloterdijk has done on the question of spheres, juxtaposed with Paul Virilio's work on architecture and the bunker architecture work of his early career, but also his own architectural practice, where he was trying to think about not simply the surface and not simply a vertical axis, but what he calls the oblique angles and surfaces, of trying to think about this in multiple dimensions. to try and make sense of the complexities of territory today. But I think that this holds true in other contexts as well. And it's this question I'm trying to raise here about how our work on geopower, geopolitics, geometrics would work if we took the air, the subsoil, the earth, questions of land, terrain, territory, earth processes and understandings of the world as the terms at stake, rather than geopolitics being effectively a synonym for the global. That there would be a concentration on the question of terrain. Terrain, it seems to me, has sort of fallen out of favor as a topic within human geography, but a geophysical element within geopolitics. So the anthropologist Gaston Gaudio has done some interesting work around the question of terrain most recently, and some of the critical work in military geographies, I think, has done something around those kind of questions. But it's to try to think about how these terms might be useful if we're looking at something. Simon's example was the question of climate change. One of the most striking, he said, was the satellite images of drought in the former Soviet Union, North Korea, Arab countries, and noting that these technologies are modes of knowing, charting, measuring, and calculating the Earth as it is transformed. And Simon noted that at the same time as I gave this volume lecture, the prominent climate activist Bill McKibben had published an article in Rolling Stone magazine that suggested the most important geometrics of our time relate to basic aspects of the climate system. And although the language isn't being used by McKibben in that article, this idea of geometrics, of different measures of the Earth, seems to be important, seems to be useful in thinking about this. Simon suggests the notion of neoliberal geometrics. What kinds of measures of the Earth are being used by neoliberal regimes, or what we're talking about here as these regimes of global calculation. Now, Simon suggests that what this kind of work could do, thinking about the question of volume, thinking about the question of metrics, the geometrics relating to the atmosphere and the ocean, and that this would be a way of, in a sense, making sense or making a way of rendering or making intelligible the notion that's being proposed of the Anthropocene. And it's that last notion that I want to pick up on in the concluding comments here. Now, I suggested at the beginning of this talk that many of the other papers today had been very explicitly to do with calculation. That's come through very clearly in the talk. And yet, the way that a lot of those had been understood, I think, was very close to what Foucault would have understood by biopolitics. They were a lot to do with populations, bodies, individuals, and groups of individuals. What I'm suggesting is that alongside that work, I'm not for a moment saying it's unimportant, but alongside that work, we also need to think about the ways these nodes of calculation or these metrics are applying to things like the Earth, the land, the world, the global. And these not simply as the frames within which these regimes of calculation take place. The spaces within which, between which, over which the regimes operate, shape and calculate is a crucial element. And it's what's being done to these, made possible by these, as objects of transformation and possibility that I think we need to think about. That alongside biopolitics, a notion of geopolitics, but not in the loose sense of global or international politics, but as a politics of the earth, drawing on what Elizabeth Gross talks about in terms of geopower, her argument about the clashing competing forces, some of which are human, more of which are living, many of which are what Jane Bennett calls vibrant matter, or what might be called animate objects. And that phrase, animate objects, was one that came to me when I was reading a wonderful little novel by Ben Marcus called The Age of Wire and String. I don't know if anyone knows this book, but it's about thinking about objects as having properties and agencies that exceed any kind of human use or human design within those. That alongside all of those crucial elements of calculation talked about today, of the reduction of complexity to number, of modes of measure, all of those things that we can understand through a notion of biometrics, what about the techniques of calculation, operations of measure and control, which are directed towards the earth, the geo, the retrieved sense of geometrics, that would include, but not be reducible to, the abstract applied arts of geometry. This, I think, would also help us to make sense of these regimes of calculation and their relation to global governance. And that such a politics of the earth, such a metrics of the earth, would aim to be appropriate to this notion of the Anthropocene, especially in terms of what Simon has called Anthropocene geopolitics. And in Anthropocene geopolitics, we would hope that in that, at least, there'd be a serious critical focus on the notion of the geo more than there's been in the past, even in critical geopolitics. Or to put this another way, why is the work Simon Dolby's doing on the geopolitics of climate change not Anthony Giddens or John Urry, both of whom have also written about the politics of climate change? That there's a real importance to a political geographical perspective to this most geographical of political questions. It's important. And the Anthropocene, for all of its problems as a term, is the term that's being used. It's the term that people are engaging with. It has some kind of currency beyond mere academic circles. And even though with our post-human perspectives, with our various critiques of the notion of anthropocentrism and so on, we may think the term is problematic, if in our engagement with it, all we do is to try and propose other notions around it, we may end up doing exactly what Peter Dickin bemoaned of geography and globalization. Yet another missed boat. We miss the opportunity to show what geographers could engage with and offer to those kinds of debates. And it's for that reason that I want to try and retrieve this sense in geopolitics rather than the notions other people have proposed of political geology or political geophysics or something along those lines. Geopolitics seems to me to be a perfectly adequate word. It's just a lot of the work that's gone under that title has been inadequate to the complexity that it seems to imply. So the Anthropocene and geopolitics, both of which, it seems to me, would benefit from thinking much more carefully about Earth and metrics, and I'd suggest also ways of making sense of these regimes of global calculation. Thank you.